Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to Craig Houston Talks To. We're back in the saddle again after a little sabbatical and a great guest to start off with. We've got Dave McKinnon from ex-Rangers, ex-Kilmarnock, ex-Arsenal, ex-Dundee, both as a player and in the business side of football. So a fantastic guest with a great insight. And just like to thank the sponsors who make these shows possible. And this episode is sponsored by Impact Glasgow, who are a builder, a great builder that I've got some personal contact with and seen their work. They're great and they help our football team quite a lot as well at Sons of Struth. So thanks very much for your continued support. And NordVPN, which we'll talk about later on. So first of all, just thanks very much, David. Introduce yourself, tell us a bit about that folk might not know, and we'll go through your story.
Yeah, well, Craig, I'm absolutely delighted to be on with yourself. You and I go back a few years, so we know a lot of secrets. But I was a professional footballer for 20 years. I started at Arsenal. I had a contract and decided that I wanted to be transferred to Dundee, which was probably one of the strangest decisions that I think ever happened at Arsenal. But I loved Dundee and my time up there and some great people. Then I was transferred to Partick Thistle. Bertie Auld was the manager. It worked out very, very well. And then a couple of injuries. I had a kidney removed, believe it or not, for tuberculosis. And I was then transferred to Glasgow Rangers, which was a great day in my life. And also my father, my late father, he was a Rangers supporter. I had the chance to go to Everton with Howard Kendall, but my dad said, if you don't sign for Rangers, I'm never speaking to you again. So it was no
contest. Sounds like a fair bit of advice.
Well, it was, and it was great. And, you know, it was difficult times there. I had some injuries again, which seemed to blight my career, but I really enjoyed it. And, you know, running out in front of the Rangers fans, because I was a Rangers fan myself, brought up, it was just incredible.
So, just going back there, when you were brought up, where were you born, and what did your football look like before you went professional?
Well, I was actually born in Milton, in a house in Rassie Street in Milton, and my father was a boilermaker in Wilson, boilermaker on Dumarnock Road, and I stayed in Orr Street in Bridgeton, behind the cinema there. A typical Glasgow single end, as they call it, you know, a room and kitchen, outside toilet. So my formative years were very interesting, to say the least, you know, having to go into a toilet in the landing that was shared by three families. So I think, you know, coming from that, it gave you a sense of where you're from. And I think it gave me an ambition to become a footballer. And, you know, my dad went to work in Renfrew, went to Renfrew for a number of years and started, you know, BB, club football, things like that, and managed to get lots of trials with English teams. and eventually chose Arsenal to go down and be a, start as an apprentice and then sign professional forms.
So did your boys' club football start out in Renfrew?
Yeah, it was Renfrew. It was football was very buoyant, you know, there, and particularly in the BB and things like that, you know, and the Life Boys and all these kind of things that, you know, people always saying, "What was that?" and it was a great upbringing, and I think my school team, we used to be beating something like 20-0 every week. And that again gave you a wee bit of an insight how you could get better. But you know, I think growing up there was a great education for me, and understanding exactly, you know, what was out there and you know, how you could better yourself.
Yeah. I take it being Renfrew based at the time and playing for clubs round about there, you would be no stranger to the racecourse pitches at Paisley, but near the airport.
Yeah, I used to play there regularly, but also the 50 pitches.
Oh, along and closer to Hillington, past that way.
They were amazing, but they were, you know, they also used to play in a lot of red ash pitches. And the amount of, I even in those days, I did slide tackles, and it wasn't the best thing to do on the red ash pitches because your legs were just torn to ribbons. You know?
I was brought up and I was born in Linwood, and our local school is Fulton. Went one worse. We had a black ash pitch.
All right.
Okay. But as you drove into the school, the away teams were coming. There was a hill that you couldn't actually see the pitch. So they would come into the changing room, and the first they would see the pitch was about 3 seconds before kickoff. And we used to be 2 or 3 nil up within 10 minutes because these people would just be shocked and stunned. But it was a crazy surface, but it was very popular in the west of Scotland. And it probably just let, the only advantage was probably let us play football in the winter when the grass pitches were off. But it was a horrendous surface. Do you wonder?
Well, you really had to control the ball, didn't you? It gave you, I think one of the things it did was, you know, it gave you, you had to concentrate 100% because, you know, whilst it was black ash and red ash, there was certain elements of it that were bigger than the rest. So the ball would bounce up strangely at different angles. But I think that helped a lot of players in the in Scotland where they played in that. And, you know, they get better understanding of ball control and how to ensure that you concentrated in your play and made sure that you'd the ball under control very quickly.
Yeah, I think the perversely the opposite's happening nowadays. That we've got, you know, our own kids' football club, and we've got some teams that they probably play 90% of their football training and matches on AstroTurf.
Yeah,
and then they go into the 11-a-side game, and they have maybe go up to maybe 25 or 50% of their games on AstroTurf. Even some of our real good teams. Yeah. It takes a bit of time to get used to it. And we've had teams in the past who just simply could not play in grass. So it's a bit of a strange process, you know. It's evolved and went 180 degrees.
I think, obviously, you know, that was a decision made lots of years ago. I think, you know, I've been at clubs, Hamilton, for example, where they'd, you know, I've got an AstroTurf pitch and it's kept in very, very good nick. And I played on it a couple of times, you know, in sort of charity games, and I actually thought it was quite good.
One of the first sort of new generation I was at was when Benbur opened up their new place about 7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, and I walked onto the surface and it was brand new. And if you closed your eyes and just walked in a straight line, you would be hard pushed to know what surface you were on over grass. But it's come on a lot since back in the days. I remember playing for our regional team and being taken out to. It was a place in the east end of Glasgow. It was the first at
Ellenville, maybe.
Ellenville. It was like playing in that table with sand flung on it. And then thinking for there, where we've went in sort of 40 years, the AstroTurf now, if it's a good one and it's looked after, right, still need maintenance. You know, you'll get a good surface.
Yeah. Just an interesting one for on AstroTurf. Remember when Fairland got them in, and what they did was it was almost like carpet tiles. They were all squares. And basically, I was chief executive of Kilmarnock, and we went to play at Dunfermline. And, you know, they were enthusing about the pitch and things like that. And Greg Shields, right back, had a tackle. And basically, one of the carpet squares came up, and a guy had to run on and put tape on it to keep it down.
So, wasn't it the sort of normal that you would see where it's a sort of rolled on type? This was actually just a more of a tile.
It was a tile. And. That was in the Scottish Premier League, so I think, you know, they've come on a long way since then.
How long ago was that, I mean?
That was probably 2006, I would imagine.
Aye, they've come on a bit since then, thankfully. So, you're in your youth, you brought out a new book, which you were kind enough to let me have a look at last week. I'm not a great reader. I'm not a big fiction. I do like non-fiction if I'm going to read anything at all. And as soon as you sent me, I was going out and I read the first chapter pretty damn quick. So that was near a proper sitting. But I managed to destroy the book in two sittings, which is tell you, that'll give you some indication of how much I enjoyed it.
You text me and said you just finished at 5:30 in the morning.
Correct. So
that's dedication.
For guilty. So I a fascinating read. And the thing, when you know someone, you think you know about their career and stuff, and just reading all their stories, it was enjoyable, it was fascinating, it was a great insight into a footballer and the back-end business in football. But if you don't mind talking about it, the early chapters when you're talking about your childhood and stuff, you had some hurdles to cross here and some tough times that you faced. Is that something that you want to talk about?
Absolutely, because I think the thing is, where this book came from, I've been asked before to write books, but the time wasn't right. And also, I consider myself as quite a private person, try and keep my own private business to myself. But when you get into the world of football, particularly as a chief executive at football clubs, and now social media, you open yourself up to a lot. I found that, you know, difficult. That's why I didn't want to do anything. And just recently in the last month, I've had to go on Twitter and social media because my publisher said, look, do this. And that's been a bit of a jump. But where this started from was I did an accident a year ago. I was coming out of a business meeting and fell down 12 stairs, ruptured an artery into my brain, and quite plainly was very lucky to survive the fall. And it almost bled out. So that was a game changer for me. And I went through months of, like, you know, rehab, because my brain had, been shaking around that much that it reset, believe it or not. And I was getting incredible things that were happening in my life, waking up during the night, thinking about things, anxiety, depression, and I thought, right, I need to get something to focus on here, because, you know, every day is, you know, different. You know, I was waking up with concussion, which I still get, believe it or not, waking up and, you know, having dreams, you know, which strangely I was dreaming in Gaelic, because my late father Willie came from the Isle of Skye, Broadford. And he used to dump me and my brother up there for 6 weeks during the school holidays. And my grandparents, their first language was Gaelic. So if we wanted anything, we had to speak in Gaelic. So we were actually fluent in it, but I hadn't spoken Gaelic for years. So that was coming to me. So my brain was resetting. The neurologist, a great neurologist at Inverclyde Hospital, was absolutely magnificent. And she talked me through the whole thing and said, this is what you'll experience, because your brain was resetting. So there was a lot of things. It was re-educating itself. So that was quite a difficult time. Also, I had an open wound at the top of my head, which had been glued, and that was still blood coming out. So I'd wake up in the morning, my pillow sheets covered in blood. And then, you know, my wife was absolutely magnificent, you know, saying, look, you need to get something, you need to go up, you need to do this. And she was very motivational for me. And then I started writing the book. So that's how it started.
Incredible. And see the talking Gaelic part. How far back would you need to go before you last spoke Gaelic?
50-odd years.
And it just came to you like that? I mean,
well, it's still in your, it's still reset somewhere in the, you know, in your brain, but, you know, a trauma like I had, it suddenly came to the fore. It's a strange thing. But what I wanted to do was write a book that was different. It was about recovery, about being positive, overcoming the challenges that this accident had thrown up. and also using some of my experiences in football that I overcame a lot of challenges in my football career, particularly a lot of injuries and illness. And I started at the very beginning and said, right, okay, well, there was a feeling for me throughout my football career that when I had success, when I had a good game, when I played well, when cup finals or whatever, it just didn't seem enough. I was wondering why. I get some therapy as well to try and get my brain back into some kind of semblance of normality. And basically the woman that did the therapy said to me, look, let's talk about your upbringing. I told her about my mother. Was an absolutely wonderful woman. And what happened was when my brother was born, she had postnatal depression. And in those days, bizarrely and just unbelievably, instead of helping them and treating them, they gave them electric shock treatment. People listen to that think, how barbaric is that? But there will be people of our vintage or my vintage that will say, oh, I remember that. And basically what it did, it knocked her life. And she used to have, periods of being okay, when she was the nicest woman in the world, and then she had periods of basically not recognising you. There's an episode I talk about in a book when I was about 8 or 9. I'm coming to home from school, go to the door, chat at the door, and she opens the door after about 5-10 minutes and says, yes, can I help you? I'm saying, so I try again, she barges me out, and she said, what are you doing? I says, it's David. She said, there's no David lives at this house. Bye. Slammed the door in my face. And that was her going through the depression and the stuff that she had because of this electric shock treatment. So what I equated that to during my football career was that, there was always, negative times after positive times because of my experience growing up. But I was able to, as I was getting on in my book, I was able to turn that into a positive, because what I really turned it in the head and said, well, if you're at a low point in your life, there's a positive time coming. And that worked for me. And I then started, I can remember going through a period after about maybe 6-8 weeks after this incident, accident, thinking about mortality, because I was told that there were 16 people trying to save my life. And I was down to not a lot of blood, so that was really, quite a revelation for me. And I thought, right, okay, started thinking about players that I played with, brilliant people, and I thought, right, let me talk about my experience with them, like David Cooper, Tommy Burns, Ali Dawson, Colin McAdam, Brian Whittaker. Really wonderful people and great experience. So I started talking about my relationship with them and some of the stories that the crazy things that we did as players, and how we dealt with being a professional footballer, because it's no easy, to be perfectly honest. And so that was me off and running. And then I thought, but right, okay, well, I've done it with players. Let me think about mortality and think about the managers that I worked under, and a lot of them have gone, Bertie Auld, Walter Smith, talk about Walter Smith, Tommy Gemmell, and it all worked into a story. And also every, beginning of every chapter, I spoke about my recovery, how I was feeling, what experience I was going through that particular day. And that's when the Gaelic thing came in, because it was the strangest thing. I was about 4 or 5 nights. I'd wake up at 3 a.m. and it was so vivid in my head. And it was actually, I could start speaking because I was relaying my conversations with my grandparents. It was the most surreal thing in it. But to be perfectly honest, my neurologist said to me, that's to be expected. It's your brain resetting. And that's what I did. So I also had a great amount of support from a guy I know, a PR guy in London called Keith Bishop. And he'd actually fallen a Premiership game in England and suffered the same as me. So he would phone me up, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks, say, right, what's happening? What's the latest? And I would tell him, and I remember he said to me once, well, he says, I've never spoken Gaelic in my life, so I don't know that one. I can't give you advice on that. But he would tell me about the concussion, about, you know, the mood swings and all that kind of thing, because it was like, it was the most surreal thing I've ever experienced in my life. But, you know, I think I'm very strong, willed and strong character, because you have to have that character to be a professional footballer, because you can train, you can be physically fit, you can be a decent player, you listen to instructions from the manager, but if you've not got a mental strength, you'll never succeed. And that's the reality of the situation. So that's where it was. So that was why the book was laid out, and you know, just evolved. And what I was doing was, like, it gave me a reason to get out of my bed in the morning. I'd get out and then say, right, okay, let's think about, you know, what I can discuss now. So I discussed a lot of things that were private, personal. I opened myself up a lot, but I think I decided probably about halfway through it, there's a lot of personal things in here, but to be honest, if it helps anyone reading it, I've actually had someone I let read the book come to me a couple of weeks ago and say, basically, you've given me an unbelievable help. And I said, well, how did that happen? He said, well, I read the book, and your experience of, you know, leaving Arsenal and you know, the legacy of that, you had a contract and you decided to leave, but you eventually, you know, put it out of your mind, because it really was...
Was you talking about letting the red balloons go?
Yeah, so it was really just the red balloon thing is actually... It's metaphorical red balloon that you let go up in the sky. You've carried this thing about with you, and you eventually let it go. And it was my wife that said to me, look, you've been carrying this Arsenal thing about you for years, and I did throughout my career, and it affected my career a lot, because what happened at Arsenal was I had been told I was, you know, making my first team debut. I actually got an injury, and, you know, my roommate Frank Stapleton and I were told early in the Monday, just keep yourself fit this week, because there's a real chance of playing against Stoke on Saturday. I get injured on the Wednesday, broke my metatarsal, and I had to get a cast on, a light cast on my foot, and elevate it for 3 weeks in my digs 400 miles from home. So that was quite an experience and a challenge, but when Frank went on to play, and I remember listening to him on the radio and thinking, oh, I could have been there, I could have done that. So I carried a lot of that about. I also had been on loan at Dundee, and they asked me to sign, and, you know, I said, no, I've got a contract at Arsenal. And then I went back to Arsenal, and the manager says, oh, you'll be playing 15 games before the end of the season. But I think that was season 75, 76, but Arsenal were through a real transition period from the double winning side. They were trying to introduce a lot of new players and young players, and that takes a wee bit of time, and they were third bottom of the league. So there was a chance of them getting out.
Getting relegated.
Relegated, and they've never been relegated. So the manager said to me, I'm not going to play you because I need the experience to keep us in the league. And I took that as a snub. I mean, I should have said to myself, right, well, that's fine. I'll work harder and prepare myself for the following season. But I'd an offer to go to Dundee. You promised me first team football. And that was the most important thing for me at that time. And I decided, whilst I had a contract at Arsenal, I decided to go and see the manager and say to him, I want you to rip that up. I'm going to Dundee. And I was very friendly with Alan Ball at the time. And he could not believe it. He actually said to me, I'll come up to the manager and I'll tell him that you got a bang in the head or something like that. That was it. So I carried that along about me, but eventually let it go. And as I said, this person that spoke to me said, that experience for me, reading that, I had an experience of something that was you know, following me around from the past. I was really angry about it, and it was affecting my day-to-day living, my relationships, and I decided, well, if Dave McKinnon could let a red balloon go, but, you know, a big contract at Arsenal, I can let mine go. And he did it, and he said, I feel 100 times better. So that was great, because that's what the book was meant to be, you know, a kind of self-help thing, because if you read it, which you have, there'll be a lot of things in that resonate, and you'll think, well, I can do that, you know.
Yeah, no, I think it's admirable, the level of detail you went into in the book with some of your, you know, things that were very, as you said yourself, very, very private to you. And I think sometimes when you get to that point where you're doing a book, I'm fortunate that somebody, I'm doing as the author of it, I couldn't write a book, somebody came and wrote a book with my story. And I found, and I think you spoke about it towards the end of the book, that process helps you personally.
Yep.
But because you're opening yourself to the world, you will always find somebody that you know, attaches herself to your story with similarities in their own life. And I think once the book goes out, once it's launched and it's read at a wider audience, that will be something that you'll just continue to get for a few years from now. But no, it was a very open story. Sometimes you read these books, and what I liked about it and what I like about talking to you is you're not a normal footballer, you're abnormal, but a normal footballer, when they talk, when they write their book, it's just about the stories. And this happened in a changing room, and this happened when we won this game, and this happened when we lost this game, and this manager. And you don't really learn anything about them. You just learn about the character that you already know, that you see in the TV throughout their career. So when I read yours and similar books, I always enjoy them more, because it's learning about David McKinnon, no learning about David McKinnon in brackets footballer. And because your story was not just about being a player, you're going to talk about your time in the boardroom, you're going to talk about your time, obviously, with the accident, you're going to talk about the health things that you discovered after that, and the stuff that you spoke about your youth, about your mother, very, very personal and private, but to read it, it was very an eye-opener. To just take a step back, hi guys, I'd just like to take a minute to talk to you about NordVPN, which is a company that I use their services. I use it majority of the time when I'm travelling abroad, when I want to keep up to date with the programmes I'm watching at the time, or more importantly to me, the sports that I want to watch when I'm abroad. So it doesn't matter where I am in the world, I can still watch the channels and the games and the sports that I want to. It also gives me security and some privacy that I'm looking for when I'm browsing the internet. They've got an exclusive huge discount available to viewers of the podcast, and they'll give you an additional 4 months free on top of whichever package you go on if you use our code. To get that, plus a 30-day, no quibble, money-back guarantee, all you need to do is log on to nordvpn.com/Craig, C-R-A-I-G, and that will get you the exclusive discount plus the 4 months free on top of whichever package you go for. So go and give them a look, guys. And certainly I've had no problem using them in the times I'm traveling abroad, so I mostly use them. Thank you very much. You're a kid in Renfrew at the time, I take it, when you signed for Arsenal.
Yes.
How does that happen? How does this kid that's playing, you know, under 15, under 16 football in Renfrew and the Paisley area suddenly end up at such a great institution as Arsenal?
Well, I played with a really good team for youths, Glasgow United, and a lot of good players played with them, and we had a really good team, and scouts used to come to every game and you know, watch the games, because, you know, I know that it's very topical just now about doing everything on the computer, looking at footage of players and saying, oh, he looks good. But unless you go and see someone, you don't get a feel for their ability, but also you don't get a feel for if they make a bad pass or they're not playing so well. How do they cope with that? Because you're not going to play well every week. So it's about that you get a full story if you go and see someone. So scouts then, there was a huge amount of scouts from English teams going to games like Glasgow United, Easter Craigs, things like that, and they would pluck players out. And actually went to quite a few teams on trial, Chelsea, Ipswich, Sheffield United, Arsenal, obviously, and had a few offers. I actually, I think my dad kind of gave me a bit of advice. He said, well, Arsenal, you know, they just won the double and things like that. You know, they're a great team. And they'd a reputation for bringing young players through. My own, where I felt comfortable was Ipswich, believe it or not. Bobby Robson was the manager. And he was a great person. And I remember playing a trial game and, you know, he was very personable. And he came to me and he said, you've got a real chance. He said, a real chance. He said, and I'd like to sign you. I thought, well, that's the manager, Bobby Robson, saying to you that. And Ipswich are a wonderful team at that stage. You know, but I signed for Arsenal and that was it. And I got on. But there was a lot of the youth team at that side at that time was full of unbelievable players. You know, Frank Stapleton, Liam Brady, David Price, David O'Leary, John Devine, Wilf Rostron, John Matthews. You know, all these guys went on to play at a decent level. And there was a lot of competition, you know. I was the only Scottish guy down there, and that was difficult.
That's unusual at that time, though. I mean, most people, their introduction into football was similar to yours, where the youth players went down south, youth players, and then flourished their career. Most of them were at that time. There had been at least two or three other Scots in the team, but you at Arsenal being the only Scot, that must have been one, difficult, and two, quite unusual for teams down south at the time.
Well, it was. There was a couple of guys went down in trial with me, but they weren't signed. So I was the only Scottish guy, and as I say, it was very difficult at times. There was a Scottish coach, Ian Crawford, who played with Hearts in the Cup Final, when they won a Cup Final, I think, in the early 60s. There was a guy, Dave Smith, who was the reserve team coach, who went on to be the manager of Dundee. Frank McClintock was a club captain, wonderful man. Peter Marinello was there. Eddie Kelly. And they kind of, you know, looked after me. And also, strangely, to a lot of Scottish fans, but Alan Ball, really, I think it's probably because we were gingers, you know. But he, from day one, you know, liked something about me and gave me some unbelievable assistance in that journey to come through, you know, at Arsenal. So him and Pat Rice were absolutely magnificent to me.
And that would be, did you go down there when you were about 16?
16,
and you were there till about 20?
20, yeah.
Incredible. It's something I wasn't aware of, to be honest with you, David, that your career had started down south. I knew, obviously, when you came to Rangers, you came for Thistle, and then later on in life, I'd seen things that you'd played at Dundee, and obviously knew you went to Kilmarnock and stuff after that. But I was unaware of that for a while. Incredible start at football. And when you went to Dundee, was it Bertie Auld that signed you? No, sorry, Bertie Auld. Tony Gemmell that signed you?
No, it was actually ex-Rangers manager Davy White who signed me. And I had the strangest introduction because I was supposed to play Dundee in the Premier League, and they were playing Celtic at Dens Park. I think I signed something in the Monday of the previous week. And Davy White said to me, right, you're making your debut, first team debut against Celtic. And I thought, well, yeah, beauty. and they'd play as Little Gleish and all that kind of thing at that time. But he said to me, he says, look, he said, you've not played for a week or two. He said, so I want you to play in the reserve fixture at Parkhead. And I said, I know, boy. And somebody tackled me and flaked a bone off my ankle and was out for, I think I was out for 14 months.
Seriously? So you've signed for Dundee?
Dundee.
And you don't play for over a year before you get to be fit enough to play your first team?
Davy White's gone. Tommy Gemmell's in. And that was it. So, and also, to compound things, you know, when I left Arsenal, Bertie Mee, the manager, said to me, Davy, he says, you're making a big mistake. He said, you will play. I've got a plan to bring in players into this first team. He said, over the next season, and you're one of them. You'll be playing here and you'll become a regular. And, but I didn't listen, which was strange. But as I'm going through this rehab, of, you know, I had two operations in my ankle and was told my career was over at one stage. And I'm looking at Match of the Day and, you know, Frank Stapleton, Liam Brady, all these players are you know, excelling in the Arsenal first team. And I thought, crikey. And even Pat Rice, because I was the understudy to Pat Rice, who actually helped me incredibly. And Pat was transferred to Watford. So that was my place, you know, but they put John Devine in. And, you know, he was basically my understudy, if you know what I mean. So I wasn't there. So he jumped into the first team and did very well. So took the opportunity. So that, and that rehab, that was a real dark place for me to cope with that, cope with being told my career could be over. Still to make my debut for Dundee because of injury. And then looking from afar where, you know, players are making their debut, and Bertie Mee was right in what he told me. So that took a lot of inner strength to overcome. But as I said to you, I've always had inner strength, and I overcame a lot of challenges to get to where I wanted to go in football. And that was just another thing. And going back to my injury and the heart things that were discovered from that, that's, if I've overcome what I've overcome to become a professional footballer, then that's, the rest's dead easy. So.
That's a good positive outlook, to be fair to you. So I didn't appreciate that when I read the book. Thinking back, it was there. I've just now put all the dots together. So you're 20 years of age, make the incredible decision to leave Arsenal, and bang, right away, almost, you've got this 14 months where you're not playing at football. I don't think it's any surprise you just read Bond for a while, Davey, because I think even without the injury, it's the sort of move that you would always think, oh, I've done the right thing. And but when you put the injury on top of that, and the fact that you had to play and you're learning well, you might not play again. I don't think it's any surprise at all that you thought at some points, was I doing the right thing?
It's not working for me. That's what.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I thought at the time, but as I said to you, you know, you as a footballer, you need that inner strength. You need that determination, because it's not always a bed of roses, you know. But also, you know, in writing my book, I believe different was for a reason. And I actually come to a lot of conclusions about things that happened to me during my career. The Arsenal one, strangely decided that was for a reason, going to Dundee, because Tommy Gemmell was there. And Tommy Gemmell, I remember saying to Tommy Gemmell, you know, what a penalty kick taker he was. He took penalty kicks and basically hammered the ball all over the goals, always scored with them. And one of the things as a young player, you want to know the secrets. What's the secret? So I remember saying to Tommy Gemmell, what's your secret about your penalty? And he said to me, Dave, he says, I've got no secret. He says, what I do is I go up, I put the ball in the spot, and I run up, get my head over the ball, and hit it as hard as I can. He says, and if I don't know where it's going, the goalkeepers get absolutely no chance. Right? And
Ted McMahon know the same philosophy about football in general, because that was the sort of thing he would do. And you played with him, didn't you? And you talk about it in a book.
But what a character he was. But so 14 years later, I'm the captain of Kilmarnock. We've come from being the second worst team in Scotland to a final day when, if we win, we get promoted. And it's one each, big crowd at Rugby Park, one each against Cowdenbeath, getting into the last 10 minutes. We get a penalty with 8 minutes to go. I'm the captain. No one else wants to take it. So I grab the ball and, you know, in my life, I'm walking up. Tommy Burns said to me, Davey said, you'll need to score with this because if you don't score, the club's going nowhere. Right? And I said, oh, no pressure, Tommy. And then he crossed himself. And I said, cheers. And so I'm walking up and I hear all the players are going, come on, you need to score, you need to score. You know, and I thought, right, okay. Well, I realised the enormity of what I was about to do. And then Tommy Gemmell's voice came into my head as I'm walking up. Put the ball on the spot. Get your head over it. Hit it as hard as you can. And if you don't know where it's going, the goalkeeper's got no chance. And that's what I did. And I scored. And Kilmarnock get promoted. So as I was writing that, strangely, my brain decided, that's why you left Arsenal. Because you'd never had that experience. So,
it's incredible. And that was something that I took out of the book. I think it's normal now. Most people in life will have some issues with mental health. And I've certainly had mine in the past. But the one thing that I'll take out of your book was that total reversal of good times are always going to have a bad time. Well, if that's the way life goes when you're here, there's always got to be one of them.
Yep.
And it's not a bad life lesson. So I need to thank you for that one, David. That was pretty good.
Well, that's true. Well, I think the thing is I never set out to make it, you know, here's a lesson and all that. It was just simply that when, you know, I never planned what I was writing. It just came every day about how I was going to get things down in paper. And when I started to look back at it and say, right, well, here's a lesson, you know, everything happens for a reason. There's someone looking after you. You know, good times will follow bad times. And also have a wee bit of belief in yourself, because I think the thing is, like, you know, I certainly, and maybe it's a Scottish thing, you know, even when I was playing at the top of my career and playing well, I never quite really believed in myself. And I think that's a lot of things. That's a lot of Scottish things where we're maybe taught not to, you know, be bigger than we are and think that. But certainly it was a big lesson for me. And also, I think realising how lucky I've been actually falling down those stairs. Because if I'd hadn't fallen down those stairs, I'd never discovered some of the other health issues that I've had. So I'm taking everything as a positive. Yeah. I've still got a lot of things to achieve in life. And I've got a lot of quests, particularly with this heart issue with ex-footballers. We need to do something about that. So you know, I think it's a real positive for me. So. Yeah.
No, and I think, again, something that you said about the just the process of writing the book as a positive for you. I felt similar when the guy was writing about mine, just making you think backwards and projecting things forward. It was good. It was a great read. So you're at Dundee. How many years did you do there?
2 years. I was 2 years there.
And then that's when the Thistle.
As I say, I didn't play for about 14 months, and then Tommy Gemmell had become the manager, and Tommy introduced me to the first team. He was a cavalier type of player, and he basically said to me, I want you to do the same. So I was like playing right back, and I was like playing right wing back as well. And you know, my drive and enthusiasm, that because I'd missed so many games, I wanted to play every game as if it was my last. And that attitude gets you through games. And very quickly, Tommy said to me, look, there's a lot of teams looking at you. He said, won't stand in your way. There's a few to get back to England and things like that. But eventually, Partick Thistle came in, and I met Bertie Auld and Tommy Gemmell at the Salutation Hotel in Perth. And there's a great photograph of Bertie Holden one side and Tommy Gemmell on the other, and me in the middle side. So that gave me a lift. But Thistle was just, it was an outrageous club. Absolutely. It was a brilliant dressing room, but, you know, talking about surviving and that, you know, you really had to have your wits about you. Some of the things that happened there were just surreal. Unbelievable things that happened in that dressing room.
And Bertie, a bit of character. I had the fortune of working for his son, Robert, in the motor trade, about 99, 2000. And the garage we worked in was out in East Kilbride, and Bertie was living in Straven at the time. Yeah. So he'd been in the garage maybe 3 or 4 times a week during the week. And I was one of the few salesmen that was working in the place at the time that was into football. So although we were obviously different ends of the spectrum, she sat and blather away, and I got a tannoy out one day, Craig Houston at the manager's office, and I thought, done. And I walked in, and there was two directors, and Robert, who was the general manager, and I didn't actually realise Bertie was in the corner. And I'm thinking, I don't know, it's a bit serious, isn't it? And Robert got up, walked around his desk, and he says, right, again, put your hand out, shut your eyes. I says, Robert, we're not at school here. Am I getting the bell? What's going on? He says, no, it's nothing bad. Just put your hand out and shut your eyes, which I did. And placed something in my hand and shut my hand. And he says, now see, before you open your hand, just to let you know, it'd be a bit of last orange bee ever to get on in one of them. And it opened up, and it was Bertie's Lisbon medal.
Oh, was it?
Aye. He was a lovely man.
He used to wear it around his neck. But it was like the strangest thing, because I'd signed... And Bertie never told me that they were part-time, to be honest. And but, you know, I tripled my wages.
So you went from Dundee, which were full-time?
Yep.
To part-time and three times a wage?
Yep. And I then got a job as well. So I was
you're full of a millionaire.
Absolutely. But I remember I came in, we were playing Dundee United at Firhill on the Saturday, and... the, you know, notice board, they put the team up, and so I'm playing, right? So I'm thinking, great, make my debut against Dundee United, which was interesting to say the least. And you know, basically arrive at Firhill 10 a.m. I'm thinking to myself, 10 a.m, the game's, it's a 3 o'clock kickoff. So I said to Big Ruffy, I says, what's this about 10 a.m.? He said, oh, you'll see. So I got there 10 a.m. and basically all the reserve teams there as well. And basically Bertie came in and put up another team sheet, and it was, he was playing, Pat Quinn, Donnie McKinnon, and reserves. So we went on to the pitch at 10:30 in the morning, and it was an hour, half hour each way, practice game. And I'm thinking to myself, right, okay, it's going to be just tactics, free kicks, or, you know, how to position yourself, corners, who to mark, all this kind of thing. And it was a boy called Ronnie Sheed playing against me. And Ronnie played the ball too far, and I got it. And I got the ball and stood in it with my hands and my hips, because I thought that, well, that's the over. Me Bertie whistling like mad. I brought you because you could tackle, he said, and run about. He said, you better start doing it, right? So I'm looking, I said, okay, right. So the game starts again, and Brian Whitaker, who played left back, he puts B. Pat Quinn up in the air, and he lets the wall at the side of the pitch. And I'm thinking, this is serious. So we started, you know, tackles are flying in, and then I get the ball at the back, and suddenly it opened. And I get through the midfield, and the next thing I see wee Bertie coming, he studs up at me, try to do me. And I'm saying, goodness, so I managed to evade him, played the ball into Jim Melrose, he scored, it was 1-0, right? So back to the halfway line, wee Bertie said to me, he says, aye, McKinnon, good job, you're fast, son. He says, but I'll still get you, I'll do you. And I'm thinking to myself, we're playing a Premier League game in the afternoon, 3 o'clock kickoff. But that was every home game we had, that's what they did. Incredible. And you really had to, you know, fly in.
Just listen to the names you're rhyming off there, and, you know, you've got Ruffy, you've got Melrose, you've got Whitaker. What a bad team.
Thistle had a brilliant team at that juncture. They had, it was Ruff, McKinnon, Whittaker, Campbell, Jackie Campbell, Andy Anderson at the back. They had, you know, Jamie Doyle midfield, Ian Gibson, Ian McDonald, Kenny Watson that used to play with Rangers, played Ali Kohara up front, Colin McAdam, Morris Johnson, Dougie Sumner.
Sorry, what a team we had. Who did Mo support at this time?
I think it was a Rangers supporter, they told me anyway. So we'd what a team we had, and we were probably in the top four in the Premier League. And there was one season, there was a huge freeze, 1979-80, and we played Motherwell and gone top of the league.
Part-time.
But the freeze came in, and we didn't play again for weeks and months, and we ended up sixth in the league. I think we didn't win a lot of games after that because we were training in school halls. We weren't fit because we couldn't find a place to train. So it was a great team, and Bertie Auld was a great manager because what he did was very good tactically, but what he did was he played mind games with you because an example, right? So remember we're training three times a week, so we were either running through Postle Park, and I remember the first time I ran through Postle Park way up Balmore Road and things like that, and he said to me, he says, right, you and Ruffy go. He said, Ruffy knows the route, right? So I'm saying, right. So he's at the front door at Fir Hill, blows his whistle, big Donnie McKinnon, he's got the stopwatch, go, right? And we get to the top of Fir Hill Road, turn round, I think it's Panmure Street, and there's a taxi waiting side of the road. And Ruffy says to me, right, come on, let's get in the taxi. I said, no, there's absolutely no chance that's going to happen, Ruffy. He said, oh, he said, you know, Bertie stands at the front door. I said, no, no chance. So he jumps in the taxi and he says, I'll get you at the end of Balmore Road, or maybe just round for the pitch, he said, and we'll run in together. So he gets the taxi. I think he goes for a fish supper or something like that. And he says, that running's no for goalkeeper, Davey. Right, so I'm running right around the streets. Managed to get to the end. I see the taxi in the distance about maybe 25 minutes later. And Ruffy gets out and starts sprinting. So he's about maybe 100 yards in front of me as we come into Fir Hill Road. And basically, I managed to clock back to about 50 yards. And then Bertie does his stopwatch and he says to me, McKinnon, I thought you were fit. He said, but imagine letting Big Ruffy beat you. I said, oh, you're right, Gaffer. I said, Ruffy's faster than you think, you know. and then he said, right, on the track. So I had to go on the track and do 12 laps sprinting. So that was the kind of things that happened, but it was outrageous. It was brilliant because the dressing room, everybody got on with each other. Everybody liked each other, and the elephant in the room was wee Bertie because he did that deliberately. He made sure that the players didn't like him, and it was always wee Bertie this and wee Bertie that. But he was playing a game because he used to smile. We used to go on the Fir Hill pitch, and there was a thing called I forget what the name of it, but where it was, you sprinted, you were. You know, there was divisions round the pitch, halfway line, 18-yard box, behind the goals, corner flags, and there was two at each station. What you had to do was the first one sprint to the next station, jog round, then come back to your spot, jog two stations, back to your spot, jog three stations, and then eventually you were sprinting the whole pitch. And I remember first time I did it, I thought, it was a coffin, it was called. That's what it was called. And I remember the first time I did it, I thought, goodness sake. And then what happened was, just when we were doing the final one, the full sprint, Bertie blew his whistle, said, stop, Ruffy. You're letting your teammates down. Back to the start again. We went to do it again. And all I heard was expletives for all the players, and I knew then that they were one. It was like three musketeers, you know, one for all, no for one. And Bertie was the enemy. And he was playing that psychological thing. And we started to realise that, and we used to try and catch him out and things like that. But he was an incredible man, you know, incredibly intelligent, and you know, a great laugh to be around. Some of the stuff that he did, and I've written a lot about that, you know, anecdotal stuff.
So how long did you do at Thistle?
I was there 4 years. And again, I had a kind of almost a life-changing injury. I just played for the Scottish League against Northern Ireland. And believe it or not, despite the fact that I had Sandy Jardine, Danny McGrain, John Brownlee, George Burley, Raymond Stewart, all playing right back, Jock Steen told me after that game, "You're in me a chance making your Scotland debut." And I went, "Oh, that's great." I think it was just being nice to me, to be honest. But I came back and then started to feel really quite ill, no energy. And then I just got tests and discovered a tuberculosis and it had gone into my kidney. So I'm 24 years of age, just have played for the Scottish League and supposed to be the next getting a chance with Scotland. And I get my right kidney removed. I'm 24. And again, I was told my career was over. And I thought, no chance, no chance. I've no worked as hard as I've worked to get back. So I had 6 months rehab and get back and played for Partick Thistle in the Scottish Cup against Clyde. And Bertie Alder was made captain. And I came back and played. And that was me. I get back and... one of the things that I did during that rehab time was think about my game, because I'd played at Arsenal and, you know, I was a far better player at that time than I had become, because I'd lost a wee bit of focus. The game was dictating to me rather than me dictating to the game. So I said to myself, something has to change. So during that 6 months, I looked at my game and said, right, you need to change your game. You need to get back to what you were. So I came back into the Partick Thistle first team and played very, very well. And Bertie Auld went to Hibs and Peter Cormack came in, and Peter wanted a change. He wanted the old school out, if you know what I mean, the Bertie people out, which happens. And, you know, I respect that and understand that because every manager wants to formulate a team, you know, that he brings in. Basically said, "Oh, you can go." He says, "You can get a club." In those days, you were under contract, even though if they didn't offer you a new contract, you still had to, you know, basically get transferred. So Everton came in for me, St Mirren, and then Rangers, and that got me my change of attitude after realising my career could be over in my kidney, got me my move to Rangers, because John Gregg did say that to me, said, you know, he says, "I watched you after your kidney operation," he said, "and, you know, every time we played you, you were the top player, your enthusiasm, your drive and all that kind of thing." He says, "and that's what made me sign you." And I thought, goodness sake. So everything happens for a reason. And it's how you can either say, "Oh, you know, life's thrown me another bummer here." You can do that, or you can say, "No, I'm going to change this and I'm going to do something." And that's what got me the Rangers move.
So when you went to Rangers, was that 82?
Yes.
And you had been 26, 27?
Just 25, going on to 26.
And so what did the Rangers team look like before you arrived? What was the sort of starting 11? And who was the right back that you were going
well,
to make sure of?
It was... one of the greatest players that ever played for Rangers, and a guy I had an unbelievable respect for, Sandy Jardine. And, you know, John Gregg's written the foreword of my book, and he doesn't do that for everyone, which I'm really honoured for him to write that. And what he's basically said was, Sandy, and I never knew this at the time, Sandy was a Hearts supporter, and Hearts, Alec McDonald was the player manager, and Alec McDonald had asked Sandy to become his co-manager. And John Gregg reluctantly agreed for him to do that and freed him. And he said, "I needed a right back, and you stood out for me, and he came in. So I came into the side, and it was a transition. Tommy McLean had left. Tom Forsyth had left. A lot of the old school, Alec Miller was still about. And I came in, and to be perfectly honest, as a footballer, the better quality that you play with, the better you become as a player, because John Gregg had and Tommy McLean was a great coach as well. The two of them were brilliant. And they used to say, Jim Stewart was a goalkeeper, right? Jim, when you get it, you roll it out to the fullbacks. So he'd roll it out to me, or roll it out to Ali Dawson. And so I'd look up, and I'd have Davy Cooper coming short looking for it. I'd Bobby Russell wanting it just inside. Robert Pritz, who was an unbelievable clever player. Jim Bett.
Yeah.
Looking along the back four, Craig Patterson and John McClelland. If they were all marked up, I'd play it into the channel for big Derek Johnson, supported by John McDonald. So it was, as a fullback, it was unbelievable to play in that team, because everybody wanted the ball. And what my job was to play it in. If I played it to Coop, I'd go and I'd overlap and get into a position where I could get into the final third and cross the ball into the box for big DJ. And that happened in many occasions. So for me, there's a saying, playing out your skin. I was playing out my skin. And I loved it. I loved it. I loved just the way that my career was back on track again. And I think we went 17 games undefeated, and we were, you know, talked about as the greatest Rangers team in a generation. Things were going great. We were top of the league. We went up to Pittodrie. Rangers hadn't beaten Aberdeen since the Premier League was formed in like 1975. We went up and beat them 2-1. And to be perfectly honest, it could have been a lot more. I had the hand in two goals. First one, I won a corner. Coop took it, and I think Derek Johnson scored. The second one, I get involved in the kind of magical things that happened with Bobby Russell and Davy Cooper, you know, unbelievable players. And I saw them wide on the right-hand side, and I thought, I'm going to join in here. So I managed to get the ball. Bobby Russell played at Coop. Coop reversed, as he always did. Bobby Russell played me in. And I knew, you know, with training, where people were. And I played it to the back post. Robert Pritz had come in, as he was told to do, headed the ball past Jim Leighton. We won 2-1. Rangers fans were absolutely magnificent that day. They were at the beach end in those days, full beach end, and, you know, the support they gave us was just incredible. And that game was brilliant, because, I say, we'd gone 17, we were top of the league, and things were going really well. And I remember coming off the pitch, and it's a left side, I see Alec Ferguson run towards me, shouting, "You're dirty," right? And then John Gregg basically giving him a kind of shoulder charge, and I dived into the dressing room.
What was Sir Alex upset with you about?
Well, because Aberdeen at that time had a really good player on the left, Peter Weir, and I'd played against him a lot of times, and it'd always been a difficult game, because he was a really, really good player. But I realised that you could talk to Peter before the game, and he actually came on as sub after about maybe 20 minutes or something like that. They changed the team, and I first said to him, I said, "I'm on my game, Peter." I said, "You better beware." And I gave him a few tackles early on, and Peter was brave as a lion, but I knew that if you tackled him early on, started talking to him, he would lose his concentration, and he would just get the ball and play it back. And that's what he did. So Alec, Sir Alec, as he's called now, was a wee bit angry because I'd thwarted his threat of Peter Weir by a bit of psychology, but also a bit of hard play. You know, fair play, but hard.
Aye, you had a personal battle to win, and that's what a lot of managers and coaches talk about. If you go and win your personal battles, and you win more than they do, it'll give you a wee bit of an edge, and it could be the difference between winning and losing or drawing. So fair play to you.
So that was that. But, you know, it all went pear-shaped because we'd beaten Borussia Dortmund in the UEFA Cup, and then had Cologne. And Schumacher in goals, and we beat them 2-1 here at Ibrox, and went across to Germany, very confident. And the Germans were very unhappy about how we'd played them at Ibrox, and in the German newspapers, big headline: McKinnon, the Rangers fullback, would have kicked a rabbit if it ran across the pitch. So we get to our hotel in Cologne. I'm rooming with Ali Dawson, and there's a lump in the bed. And I'm saying to myself, what's the heck's that? Ali's saying, what's that? So I lift it, and there's a dead rabbit in the bed. So we quickly changed our rooms and go in. But that game, it was in their old stadium. I think there was about maybe 70,000 there, and I think it was about 15,000, 20,000 Rangers supporters. But we were expected to win because we were playing so well. And before the game, they were practicing volleys from the edge of the box. Like Barsky, that played from the winger, he was crossing the ball back to the... And I'd say to Ali Dawson at the time, better keep your eye on for that, because don't let them get a cross in. And they were volleying balls in the top corner. First 20 minutes, they're 4-0 up. Four volleys into the top corner. And it was just... And then the game settled down. I gave away a penalty, which I think was outside the box. But so we could beat 5-0. And what we should have done was said, that's a one-off. But we didn't. We let it linger in our minds. And what happened was, when I'd get the ball at the back, now I'd look up.
They weren't there.
Everybody's back was turned because the confidence came out. And you know, when I look back at it, I think, you know, psychologically, the players should have taken ownership. And I think maybe, you know, the management should have said at that time, look, this is a one-off. But it was lingered. How can you get beat 5-0? And we were slaughtered in the papers, you know, disgraceful, this kind of thing. And it really affected the team. And we ended up third in the league when Dundee United won it.
That was, I think, my first season going to watch any Rangers games would have been about 79, 80. And although Rangers had won trebles and stuff in the past, but I had no memory of that. I was only a kid. I would have been about 4 or 5. So around about 81 was when I really started going, and I'd have been about 9 year old. I was at the Dortmund game. I remember, and oddly enough, we were sitting near the Dortmund fans, and this guy came down halfway through the first half with leopard skin trousers, a skin tight but wavy shirt.
Rod Stewart, was it?
And the hair. I like Rod Stewart. I thought Rod Stewart went to support the Dortmund. That was one of my earliest. We'd played Dukla Prague, I think, the year before. Uh-huh. And we get put out in away goals. And I remember Rangers winning. This must have been the second leg, and I was at that at home. And my dad having to explain to me on the way back to Linwood how Rangers weren't in Europe anymore. And I'm like, but we won. So that was sort of my early formative years as a fan.
The Dortmund game was incredible because the Westfalen Stadium, where Dortmund play, it was full to capacity. And that was the Ibrox was modelled in the Westfalen. Right. Stadium, and it was incredible. And you know, my game was getting forward, but also defending first and foremost as a right back.
That's a novel idea these days.
But that's what I was. And so I defended first, but I knew when we get forward, I could get forward. John Gregg said to me, he said, "I don't want you crossing the halfway line tonight," and that's what I did. So I just defended, but this upbringing I'd had at Arsenal about learning the game. Defending was easy for me. It was all about positioning, about communication. So I actually loved defending. So I remember that night, you know, we were throwing our bodies in the line and all that kind of thing. Drew 0-0 because we weren't up the park to score, and came back and beat them 2-0 at Ibrox. And, you know, people talk about the European nights at Ibrox. That was incredible. I mean, the experience of playing in that game in front of the fans, all the fans were behind us, they cheered from start to finish. The players, and what I think is, you know, getting into chief executive at clubs, what the clubs have to do is align every aspect of their operation, from the boardroom to the dressing room, to the players, to the football management, to the staff, and to the fans. Because if you don't align everything, you know, if the fans feel that they're disenfranchised in any way, it doesn't work, because poor performances will be rightly analysed. But the fans, you know, if they're aligned with the vision within a club, and that's what you have to do. So it's all aligned. Clear objectives are set out. Clear strategies are set out, in which what every component, you know, board, players, staff, fans can make to that plan. It all works. On that night against Dortmund, it was clearly aligned. Everything was there. Everybody, the club at that time was really aligned. The fans were just magnificent. They cheered us off the park. It was a great performance. And, you know, the great players played, the Coopers this world. But again, it went pear-shaped against Cologne.
And do you think that single 90 minutes of football caused that whole thing, the wheels to start coming off? Is that against, as simple as that?
Against Cologne, yeah, absolutely. Because we played Cologne at Ibrox, and it was just after the World Cup when Schumacher had halved Battiston of France in two and stayed on the park. And as you remember, at Ibrox, in those days, there was a warm-up area under the main stand.
Davey, I used to spend many, many an hour standing. We were in Section J, which is about one to the right, yep, of the director's box. And that was the only section when I started going to Rangers games that had any season tickets. Season tickets, there was a few hundred of us. And it was before they bricked it all in. I used to come up early. I used to play my game for Linwood Rangers in the morning and get my daddy to take me as soon as. And just you and John McClelland and all these guys. And I was a sort of budding centre half, and I was playing for the school. I would play a couple of years up, they would stick me right back. So you and McClelland and that would be the ones I'd watch. And I've got a distinct memory of the three balls that were hanging, slightly different heights.
That was medicine balls.
You used to go bang, bang. And they did
that training, medicine balls, which was a bit surreal. But on that Cologne game specifically, Schumacher had just come back, right, for the World Cup, and he was a crazy guy. And I remember we were running and warming up and things like that, and he had a ball and he was booting it off the wall and catching it, right? So all the players were keeping away from him. And I remember running and then turning just about maybe 5 yards before I got to him. And as I ran to him, he turned, whacked the ball off my face. And, you know, he was a giant. I thought, you're not getting away with this. So him and I were rolling about in the red blaze there before the game starts. And Big Peter McCloy came along and pulled us apart. And I knew a bit of German because Arsenal had played a lot of tournaments in Germany. So I picked up a lot of German, particularly how to swear. So I was swearing at him in German, and he was raging. He was trying to punish me. Oh, it was outrageous. And then the game started. And we'd a thing, I had a great understanding with Robert Pritz. And I knew if he got the ball in midfield, I would make a run forward. And he would play the ball into me. And then I could cut it back or get it into Big Derek Johnson or John McDonald. So after about 5 minutes, he's got the ball in midfield. And I see him. And he doesn't have to say, and it's telepathic. So I start running. And he overcooks it. And it's running into the Cologne box. And I see Schumacher leaving his line.
There you go.
And he's running. And I'm thinking, I'm no going to bottle it here. You're getting it. So the two is, it was almost like a kung fu kick. So he kicks me in the chest and I kick him in the chest. And we're down in the penalty box. And their players have come up and, you know, again, swearing in German, which I understood. And I was swearing back at them. And the referee comes up and he's from Sweden. Right, and he's so laid back, you'd never believe. And he said, pulls his apart and says, "Gentlemen, if you don't start to play nice, I will send you off." And that was it.
Leaving a yellow?
No, leaving a yellow. And I thought, good on you, you know. And then in the second half, a ball came out to me 25 yards out. It's on YouTube. And I got my head over it and I hammered it. into the top corner. So it's getting into the top corner, and the big man throws himself and turns it around the post. And I thought, you might have let that get in, big man, you know. Because it'd have been a screamer of a goal, to be honest.
Probably find those highlights of that tackle. You and the goalkeeper get shown in France quite a bit that time as well.
Well, it certainly was quite an experience, and but a good one. But then, as I say, we beat them when we thought, right, 2-1, I think we won. And we'd every confidence to go in there and probably getting a draw or something like that and progressing. But we never. And that changed the complexity of things. And sometimes that does things to a club and a team. The good teams, if they, you know, are beaten, they use it psychologically. They turn it in its head of, that's a one-off. You'll never experience that in the season. Let's get back on track. But we never did that, you know. And that wasn't good. And then, ironically, I get injured because right back was my position, and I get injured up at Pittodrie again in January, and I was out for 6 weeks with an ankle injury. Ali Dawson came in and played right back and was just magnificent. He was a really good friend of mine, Ali. It's so sad that he's gone. And I knew then that the way Ali was performing, I had to play in another position. So I ended up playing left back, occasionally right back, centre half, right midfield, centre midfield. And I got the tag when John Greig left and Big Jock came. He said, McKinnon's a great utility man because I can play him anywhere. And once you get that utility man tag, you're finished.
What's that? What's that?
but surprisingly for me, you know, I've done the stats. Alistair Aird, who writes some great Rangers books, he did the editing of my book. And Alistair came up with the stats, and I'd played 177 times for Rangers, so I'm proud of that.
Hi guys, I'd just like to take a minute to talk to you about NordVPN, which is a company that I use their services. I use it majority of the time when I'm travelling abroad, when I want to keep up to date with the programmes I'm watching at the time, or more importantly to me, the sports that I want to watch when I'm abroad. So it doesn't matter where I am in the world, I can still watch the channels and the games and the sports I want to. It also gives me security and some privacy that I'm looking for when I'm browsing the internet. They've got an exclusive huge discount available to viewers of the podcast, and they'll give you an additional 4 months free on top of whichever package you go on if you use our code. To get that, plus a 30-day, no quibble, money-back guarantee, all you need to do is log on to nordvpn.com/Craig, C-R-A-I-G, and that'll get you the exclusive discount plus the 4 months free on top of whichever package you go for. So go and give them a look, guys, and certainly I've had no problem using them in the times I'm travelling abroad, so I mostly use them. Thank you very much.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.